And if you were sitting in Moscow, how would you see this right on your borders as anything other than an aggressive act? And so you react. We are closer to war with Russia at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And just how dangerous this is, there's something unprecedented. In the new Cold War, by whatever name, there are now three fronts that are fraught with war with Russia. The Baltic region, where we're building up, right on Russia's borders. Ukraine, which remains the political epicenter of the new Cold War, and Syria.
That's Stephen Cohen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Cohen on reheating the Cold War. Winston Churchill once observed, "The further back you go, the farther forward you can see." We know little of Russia and its history, beyond bears, Siberian winters, the Kremlin, and Dr. Zhivago. The United States emerged victorious at the end of the Cold War. An era of cooperation was to be ushered in. What should have been an opportunity to create a structure for peace and stability did not happen. Instead of an inclusive security system, the U.S.-led NATO military alliance expanded to the east. Hardliners in Washington, goaded by the military-industrial complex seeking more profits from weapons sales, have vilified and demonized Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. The media followed in lockstep. A reheated Cold War with a new arms race and the catastrophic dangers of hot war are the last things humanity and the planet needs. Our guest today is Stephen Cohen. He's regarded as one of the foremost experts on Russia. He's Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies, History, and Politics at NYU and Princeton. He is a nation contributing editor and author of many books, including Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. I talked with Stephen Cohen in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
December marks the 25th anniversary of the end of the Soviet Union in 1991. And just 74 years before that, the old Tsarist state collapsed. That's quite cataclysmic events for a people and a nation to endure.
So far as I can think, unprecedented for a major state, a historical state such as Russia is. In fact, I think it's never noted in this country, though it is in Russia, that if you had to ask what factor, historical factor, political factor, has most influenced Putin's leadership in Russia since he became president in 2000, I think becoming the head of a state that collapsed twice in the lifetime of a person in 74 years. And the collapse of the Russian state has a long and ominous history. People who know Pushkin and Boris Godunov know that that was the backdrop, the collapse of the state, of the wars among the boyars, the princes, to put a new czar on the throne. And that became known in Russia as Smuta, S-M-U-T-A, and it's translated in English history books weekly as Time of Troubles. There's always a chapter in an elementary textbook, The Time of Troubles. But I would have translated it something like The Time of Great Misery. Because typically in the Russian mind, and historically what happens is when the Russian state collapses, the people fall in misery. They lose whatever lifestyle they had. Foreign invaders encroach on Russian territory. Something approximating a political or military civil war unfolds in Russia. So it's the dread of all dread. And this happened in Russia, of course, with the revolution in 1917. And when you talk about the Russian Revolution, as people will this year in 2017, it's the centenary. Russia will be full of discussions of the revolution. In fact, just the other day, Putin encouraged the country to discuss the revolution as a way of healing class and historical wounds. And in the West, there'll be a lot of conferences in the. So it's an important one of these anniversaries that'll generate a lot of discussion. But the one mistake that's made is when we talk about the Russian Revolution, we talk about 1917. But in fact, the Russian Revolution included the Civil War. So the revolution is from February 1917 until the Bolsheviks, the communists, finally won the Civil War in about late 1920, 1921. And so when you put the Civil War in and the millions who died and all the foreign armies running across Russia, that's the image Russians have of Smuta, time of troubles, the collapse of the state. So Putin, a relatively inexperienced young man, in some ways an accidental president, becomes the head of a state that's collapsed twice in, say, his father's lifetime. And I think that any biographer, interpreter Putin, has to begin with that circumstance, that historical mandate or backdrop that he inherited, and that much he's done inside Russia has been influenced that. In a sense, it's a never again. His mission is to make sure that the Russian state, and not so it can conquer the world, but so it can protect its people at home. Because even in 1991, in the aftermath of the 90s, people lost their social benefits, 75% plunged into poverty, longevity for men dropped to about 57 years, eradicated epidemics revived in Russia. It was a horrible decade, the 1990s, though they're still glorified here with the time of Yeltsin. So I think, yes, a state that collapsed twice in one person's lifetime has to be where we begin to think about how Putin is ruled or tried to rule at home.
And then, of course, there's the cataclysm of the German invasion of 1941, resulting in 20-plus million casualties.
The official figure of Soviets, it's not only Russians, but all Soviet citizens, is 27.5. But there's no way of knowing. I'm not a specialist on World War II, but I did some reading for a lecture I used to give at Princeton. And to bring it home, of kids, boys, who were called up when the Germans crossed the border on June 22, was it, 1941, high school boys, of every 100, 3 returned. So imagine your own high school class, and you graduate with 100 guys, and 3 come home are still alive at the end of 4 years. I mean, that's a catastrophe. It is a sacred holiday in the remembrance of the 27 million, and that's why Ukraine awakened such ferocious reactions in Russia. When you get guys who look and smell like neo-Nazis running around burning up people, as they did in Odessa, 2014, it awakens memories of World War II and the Nazi occupation. And it's still worse when these people are supported, at least rhetorically, by Washington. So it's a very bad development.
We'll talk more about the Ukraine during this conversation. But just going back to World War II, in terms of the popular culture here, mm-hmm. It was all about D-Day, the American sacrifice, the American victories, the march into Europe, to Berlin, which actually the Soviet troops reached first, and that kind of thing. Many, many movies like Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, not to underplay their sacrifice and heroics, but in terms of proportion, there's a real gap there.
Saving Private Ryan was shown in Moscow. They don't censor this stuff anymore. They show everything, if only for commercial reasons. Theaters can make more money importing good Western films or glittery Western films than they can making their own. But Russians did resent that, though it was a powerful film. I mean, the numbers are overwhelming. That the German army was defeated, crushed, broken on the Eastern Front, the Russian front, not by the Normandy invasion in, what was it, June 1944. Has opened the first American National Museum of the History of World War II in New Orleans. I haven't been there, but the first prospectus of the museum that they put out to fundraise, which was from Tom Hanks and Spielberg and the Hollywood mythmakers, virtually deleted the Russian role in World War II. We were attacked at Pearl Harbor, and then we went to Normandy 3 years later, and we went to Berlin, and that was the end of it. The Russians won the war in Europe, and we won the war in the Pacific, which seems to be a fair evaluation. But they're startled to hear that. And if you do the numbers, casualties, German casualties, weapons destroyed, civilians who died, and I think as the generations went on in America, the war became not so much a memory, but a work of fiction, in which, of course, the Americans prevailed. But this is very important, and of course, Europeans understand this. We see now with the new divisions in Europe, a new debate over the war. Was the Red Army a liberator or an occupying army and all the rest? In terms of Russian history today, with the revolution in dispute, and even though the church plays a very big role, the numbers of people who are actually observant is relatively small in Russia. The war is the one indisputable sacred memory of the war, indisputable holiday.
What aspect of the Bolshevik Revolution is in dispute?
Well, the whole Russian Revolution, the rupture with Tsarist history, is now widely debated in Russia, whether it was a good or bad thing. By the way, that was a big debate in the West for many years, so it's perfectly normal. I mean, we're still debating the French Revolution. You remember that famous thing that Chou Enlai was supposed to have said to French reporters, that he went, what was it, for the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution? And as he got off the plane, he was then, I think, prime minister or foreign minister of China, communist China, and they said, Premier Chou, how would you evaluate the impact of the French Revolution? And he said, too early to judge. Yeah. Well, in a way, it's true. I mean, the real revolutions, not coups, but real revolutions unfold over decades and generations. So now that censorship, historical censorship, I exaggerate only maybe 2%, has been ended in Russia. Gorbachev ended it. Has not been reopposed by Putin. By the way, the stories that the Washington Post and New York Times periodically publish that Putin's rehabilitated Stalin are 1,000% false. He's done no such thing. He simply allowed a full national debate about Stalin. And a lot of people still admire Stalin. Polls show the country's maybe divided 50-50, including the younger generation, about whether Stalin was a positive or negative figure. But what emerges is that all these issues of the revolution, having been opened up to discussion by Gorbachev and continued these past 25 years, are very much alive. What did it mean for Russia? Was the break with Tsarism necessary for Russia's development? Did Russia lose its soul or its past? And let them argue about this. This is healthy. In some provincial towns, there's still the censoring of this topic, just as it was in the United States when I was growing up, when slavery was presented to us as a very benign institution. I grew up in the Jim Crow South, so naturally, and there was longing for the lost Confederacy and all the rest. But it took, generations for that to change in the textbooks. So Russia's going through this period of re-exploring its past. All good, I think.
One of the fascinating aspects of what happened when the Soviet Union dissolved was the negotiations between Gorbachev and the U.S. in terms of not just the reunification of Germany, which Russia acceded to, which is quite a concession given the history of Germany and Russia, but also that there were assurances apparently given, not in writing, that NATO would not expand to the east. What is the veracity of those reports, and is there any documentation or scholarship to back it up?
Assurances were given to Gorbachev that NATO would not expand eastward, but you have to remember the context. German reunification was very much wanted by the United States, President Bush, the Chancellor of Germany, Kohl, but it was semi-opposed by Mitterrand, the president of France, and Thatcher of England. They still feared a resurgent, reunited Germany. It wasn't so much they opposed it, but they weren't keen on it. They weren't pushing it, and they dragged their feet. So Gorbachev really became, because these were the parties of the occupying powers after World War II, they still had the legal right to decide the fate of Germany. Gorbachev became the decisive vote. And it was hard on him, you're right, because so many Soviets had died. But he favored German reunification. The issue then became, you reunite Germany, but where do you place it? Is it sort of alone? Remember, the Warsaw Pact hadn't dissolved then yet. So where is it between NATO and the Warsaw Pact? The wall had come down, the Berlin Wall, but events were unfolding. So Bush proposed that it be in NATO. And this was really a hard sell for Russia because NATO was the military enemy and now this reunited Germany is going to be in NATO. And I think that the reason that Mitterrand and Thatcher were not like this idea, it was a way of keeping Germany under control by putting it in NATO, not letting it go off on its own. But for Russia, it was very difficult. And so Gorbachev and the Soviet foreign minister then, Shevardnadze, were told that if they agreed to this, both the reunification of Germany and Germany as a member of NATO, comma, NATO would not, as James Baker, then Secretary of State, said, expand one inch to the east. Now, that report appeared in a book by Condi Rice, who was part of the negotiating team. Later, people denied it had happened, and it had not been codified in a treaty. But it was in writing. There were a lot of documents. And a party to this negotiation were the Germans themselves. I think his name was Genscher, the Social Democratic foreign minister of Germany, was eager to reassure the Russians. So he made commitments on behalf of Germany. But so did the Americans. Later, people said it didn't happen, that they never made this commitment. They either misunderstood or they lied to protect their own reputations, because these were people who later favored NATO expansion under Clinton. In order to reconcile being down with the new program, people began to fuzz. Like Baker said, well, the Russians misunderstood. This wasn't about the East, but it was about East Germany. It made no sense. He's told that to various people. But there is something called archives. And in the last, say, 10 years, a number of American scholars have gone into the archives. And there's an article in the very newest issue of International Security, very detailed. But he's about the third guy to go in these archives. And he has confirmed that the Russians were given assurances. Now, he asked an interesting question. Are assurances, short of treaties, binding on a great nation? Now, the Russians have, ever since then, accused the United States of repeatedly breaking its promises to post-Soviet Russia, beginning with NATO expansion, but in many other cases as well. But that's the kind of original sin in their mind. And since then, as Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, said in December, Washington has behaved treacherously toward Russia. And if you have this mindset among the political establishment in Russia that we, the United States, are treacherous, we don't keep our word, this is bad. But on this case, it's case closed. The documents make it clear that assurances were given to Gorbachev and to Shevardnadze. The argument is, by the people who practice realpolitik, Gorbachev should have gotten it in a treaty. So he's to blame, which is blaming the victim, right? But even had there been a treaty, it wouldn't have mattered. Clinton was determined to expand NATO. They would have broken the treaty, just the way Bush, what was it, in 2002, withdrew from unilaterally from the very codified anti-ballistic missile treaty, thereby opening up the catastrophe we have today with missile defense. He just said, we're out. We're out of here. We quit. So Clinton could have done that, too. But historically, as a matter of record, these commitments were given to Russia that NATO would not expand.
The veteran diplomat George Kennan, who I believe you knew at Princeton, warned against NATO expansion to the east. What was his thinking?
Well, he put it very succinctly. He said, if you do this, there'll be a new Cold War. And he said that, I think, in 1997. And George was a very conservative man socially and culturally, and his attitudes about these things were sometimes horrifying. But as a thinker, and as a man who knew Russia, and as a man who operated within history, he knew this would mean. I mean, it really, a young kid would know what it mean. If you're going to move the full might of your Cold War military alliance all across Europe, from Berlin to the Baltics, which we've now done, obviously it's going to have a very negative result on relations with Russia. I mean, this was a no-brainer. The question is, that needs to be researched, is why they did it. Some people say Clinton did it because that guy Richard Morris, who was then working for Clinton, told him that Clinton wouldn't win unless he carried ethnic votes in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and they were all from the Baltics and Poland, and they wanted to be in there. I mean, who knows why he did it? But don't ever forget that when a country joins NATO, it has to standardize its military equipment by buying from American weapons manufacturers. So it's good business.
But rewinding the tape a little bit, going back to that time, NATO is predicated on the threat of the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact. The Warsaw Pact is dissolved. What's the raison d'etre for NATO?
Well, I don't know what it is. I mean, ideally, NATO would have disbanded as well, and a new security structure for Europe. It's kind of laughable when you think about it. People today blame Putin or Russia for trying to destroy the post-Cold War security order in Europe. But Russia was completely excluded from that security order. It wasn't a member of NATO. NATO expanded toward Russia. So the security they claimed to have built was on an anti-Russian premise. We'll move NATO to Russia's borders. There were a lot of alternatives. It's one of the great lost opportunities in history. And the Russians have been proposing ever since that there be a new security order for Europe. But there's no interest in the West, of course. NATO expansion has been catastrophic. And the answer is, but look how it saved the little countries who had been victimized by Russia over centuries. And my answer is twofold. First of all, NATO is not a non-selective fraternity. You don't get in by raising your hand and saying, I want to join. If NATO is a security organization, you only bring in members who enhance your security. Bringing in these countries has undermined our security. Just look at what's going on today. Secondly, these countries themselves, small countries living in the shadow of Russia, should have been encouraged. They could have had security guarantees to negotiate and do diplomacy with Russia. But almost none of them have ever pursued any diplomacy with Russia. They punch Russia in the nose in various ways and then run and hide behind NATO. And so now you have this very substantial NATO buildup on Russia's western borders. And you mentioned World War II. It is said in Russia among, I don't like to call anybody an ordinary person, but among non-elite people, and within the elite, that as they look at what NATO's doing, has been doing since mid-2016, bringing troops and equipment, missiles, into the Baltic regions, Poland, Romania, that, and this is a very important thing Russians say, because it's the memory of World War II, never since June 1941, when Hitler's armies crossed the border, has Western military power been amassed on Russia's western borders until now. And it's true. So stop and think what that means to Russians when they see all this Western power amassing. And ordinary artillery can now hit St. Petersburg. You don't even need missiles. It's a few hundred kilometers away. So if you worry about kicking over tombstones and loosening ancient demons on the land again, and it's not NATO. I mean, after all, Washington runs NATO. Washington's the boss of NATO. We go through the pretense that all the other countries have a vote, but it's an American-controlled organization. The commander of NATO is always an American general. So this has been Washington's bipartisan policy. Nothing could be more unwise.
In a recent speech, kind of a State of the Union address, Putin said, I'm quoting here, Russia is not seeking conflict with anyone. Unlike some foreign colleagues who see Russia as the enemy, we do not seek and never sought enemies. We need friends. And then he added, but we will not permit harm to our interests. So how much of that is political boilerplate, and how much of it is core belief?
The Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, which have misreported Russia along with the cable networks for years now, expressed astonishment that he said that, which tells us something very important. They never read or listen to what Putin says. You could tell by the coverage, and Putin talks a lot, and everything he says is in English at Kremlin.ru, in pretty good English, within hours. Everything he says, full speeches, short interviews. That unlike the correspondents of the Cold War period, who were desperate for information and parsed every word the Soviet leaders said, these people don't read Putin at all. And the evidence is he's been saying exactly that, that we want to partner with the West, but we want to be treated as an equal, and we're going to defend our national interests. He's been saying that since the day he became president of Russia 17 years ago. But this demonization of Putin, which is an entirely new institution, has created a mindset from John McCain to the editorial pages of the Washington Post and New York Times, is that they know what Putin must have said because they know he says only bad and evil things about the West. In fact, the axiom now is that Putin has pursued an anti-American, anti-Western foreign policy. And this simply isn't factually true. From day one, Putin sought to achieve with Washington the real partnership that Yeltsin wanted but got from Clinton, a pretend partnership. That is, a partnership of a supplicant nation. And Putin's been very consistent. And his speeches, which are, they just collect them in the favorite speeches collected in a book. It's all there. It's one of the major themes. To this day, Putin has a habit that aggravates hardliners in Moscow. He continues to refer to our American partners. He uses the word, our American partners, our British partners. And they say, why is he calling them partners? They're our enemies. They're stabbing, they're trying to undermine us everywhere because that's his mindset. That partnership is the basis. If you accept my premise that Putin was sent by history to rebuild Russia and make sure it never collapses again, his number one mission is to riff on Donald Trump, making Russia great again at home, getting people their pensions and their lifestyles back and rebuilding infrastructure. For that, he needs, obviously, no conflict abroad. And he needs partners, financial partners, technological partners. And the original idea would be that the primary bilateral relationship that Putin's Russia would strive for would be Berlin and Beijing. This was a concept that went back in Russian history and had been picked up by a man by the name of Yevgeny Primakov, who died not long ago and was Putin's foreign policy mentor, that Russia should be a partner with, but never fully part of, East or West. It was a kind of Eurasian nation. Blame God, blame history. And it should have good relations with Beijing and with Berlin.
You're listening to Stephen Cohen on Reheating the Cold War. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The only relationship, I've always thought, in recent times, that Moscow needs with what has been a very capricious Washington is nuclear security. They don't need our money. They don't need our technology. They can get this from Europe and from, if they want to develop energy or whatever else. We always used to say, oh, they can't modernize without us. Well, on the modernization front, we're falling behind. Our infrastructure is falling apart, too. But they can get what they want, what they need from elsewhere. But what they need is security from the United States. Secure borders, NATO and the rest. So Putin's, we are a reliable partner if we're treated as an equal, has been his constant foreign policy motif since he came to power. And yet it's all been erased since the Ukrainian crisis broke out in 2013, 2014. But people here who are supposed to study Russia, and I'm not so sure even about some of my scholarly colleagues, how much they read him, don't read him. They seem not to, because you'll hear a report on a speech he gave and you'll go to yourself, oh my God, did he really say, is he that aggressive? Then you read it, he said nothing of the sort. All he said was, we really want to be partners, equal partners, but if you mess around with us, we'll push back. And the only thing that makes the newspapers is we're pushing back.
And part of that demonization, you mentioned some of the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the cable networks. Well, The Economist has a cover story, Putinism, with a very scary photograph of Putin with MiG-25 jets in his eyes in blazing red, and then describes Russia as a rotten state and asks the question, how to contain Vladimir Putin's deadly dysfunctional empire?
We got a problem here, which we ought to talk about a little bit. If a person of any public prominence or with a public record of commentary and any credentials says that what you just read from The Economist simply is not true, it's a falsification of reality, that what does it mean, rotten? Russia has rebounded even under the sanctions. Inflation is down to 7%. The World Bank, the IMF, say Russia will begin to grow again probably at about 1.5% in 2017. So they rebounded even as the sanctions remain in place. So I don't know what the word rotten means. It just means they don't like him. But if you say that, and it's heard in the mainstream, then this neo-McCarthyism that's been unfolding in this country for 2 or 3 years and peaking now, you will immediately be labeled a Putin puppet, a Putin apologist. And it's very hard to get the counter-narrative into the mainstream. In reality, if you were to sit down and in a either scholarly or an attentive way study Putin's foreign policy since he came to power, it is fairly clear that he has been primarily reactive, not proactive. That is, not an aggressor, but a reactor. Remember what was going on just before the Ukrainian. The Ukrainian crisis had been cooking for a decade. We, the United States, and our agents, the Soros Foundations, the National Endowment on Democracy, we've been very, very busy in Ukraine. Victoria Nuland told Congress we'd spent $5 billion building democracy there before the crisis. Probably it was more like $50 billion, because not all that money flows through budgets. And what does it mean to build democracy? It means to create a country aligned with us, because there's probably less democracy in Ukraine today in 2017 than there was when they overthrew Yanukovych in February 2014. So remember how it happened. In the months leading up to that and the days leading up to the Ukrainian crisis, what was Putin doing? He was presiding over an enormously successful Sochi Olympics, which the United States did everything, short of outright sabotage, to make turn out badly. We boycotted it. We warned that the Chechen or Dagestani terrorists not far from Sochi, it wouldn't be safe. There was some attempt to keep families from going, that they wouldn't be safe. But Putin, and when I say Putin, it's not Vladimir Putin alone, it's the team, the leadership team he created. One way or another, created an enormously successful Sochi Olympics, now called into question by these doping charges, which are themselves a kind of, I don't know, what's the old expression? The kettle calling the pot black or whatever it was. We're the leading dopers in the world, only we get a letter from our doctor saying it's okay. We've learned that recently, by the way. But why would a guy who had gone to all this effort, $50 billion worth, to put on an Olympic in a climate where it shouldn't really been, build all that infrastructure, roads and railways and arenas and hotels, and demonstrate that Russia was a worthy member of Western civilization, the next day wake up and say, I think I'll invade Ukraine. I mean, this is the story, that he went off and invaded Ukraine. He didn't. He reacted to what was going on in Ukraine, which was very much a Western encroachment. And it wasn't just economic. It wasn't just benign economic partnership. It was part of the whole long-term effort to bring Ukraine into NATO. The documents were there to be read. And he reacted. Now, we could argue that he reacted unwisely. You might say he overreacted. For example, Crimea. Was it necessary to annex Crimea, or as Russians say, reunite with Crimea, so quickly? What was wrong with waiting? Crimea's status would have been a terrific diplomatic chip to play with the United States and the new regime in Kiev. That if, look, if you want X, Y, and Z, including Crimea in Ukraine, you're going to have to make concessions and guarantees to us. And undoubtedly, we know that was debated in the Kremlin. There was a debate about Crimea. But we also know that Putin was given intelligence information that gravely worried him, that there was going to be a march on the Russian historical and strategic naval base on the Crimean peninsula. So he was presented with a scenario by his intelligence people that there was grave danger. Now, people say Putin's a former KGB guy. I say good. Good. Because he knows how to evaluate intelligence. He knows false information from authentic information is a good thing in this era, I think. But there was a debate. But we could argue that he overreacted. You can make a case. But he was reacting. How can you say that after what the stunt we pulled in Kiev, overthrowing a government or abetting the overthrow of a legally, and it was recognized that the Ukrainian election had been fair, the election of Yanukovych, abetting the overthrow of a government, bringing an unelected regime to power. They didn't even impeach Yanukovych. They just frightened him to death. He thought he was going to suffer Allende's fate, and he ran. Taking it over, recognizing it immediately, bringing these guys to Washington, with McCain and the others in the streets egging him on. Did we think Russia wouldn't react? But why is that Russian aggression? You know, politics is probably 85% perception. And if you were sitting in Moscow, how would you see this right on your borders as anything other than an aggressive act? And so you react. We are closer to war with Russia at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And just how dangerous this is, there's something unprecedented. In the new Cold War, by whatever name, there are now three fronts that are fraught with war with Russia. The Baltic region, where we're building up, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Romania, right on Russia's borders, build up. Ukraine, which remains the political epicenter of the new Cold War, and Syria, where American and Russian planes are flying. I don't recall during the 40-year Cold War, there ever being a case where there were so many fronts where hot war was truly possible. This is exceedingly dangerous, and therefore we got to get the story of how we got here right. And we now are living through a moment when absolutely from left, I wouldn't say from the right, but from the center and liberals and all the media they control, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the cable stations, except Fox, which is so confused about Trump, it doesn't know what it thinks about anything. But CNN and MSNBC and NPR and PBS. The answer is all this came about because Putin's an aggressor. We played no role in this. So if we did nothing wrong in the last 25 years, there's no reason for us to rethink anything or change our policy. And that is the bipartisan position. Analytically and historically, it's not only incorrect, it's very dangerous. And by the way, that's one reason why Trump so agitated these people, because he basically said, I don't believe anything these people have said for 25 years, and I know more than the generals, and I know more than the foreign policy types, which he might, but since they've gotten everything wrong, maybe he does know something, I don't know. But they are clinging to this orthodoxy of 25 years, and particularly of the last 16 years, and especially of the last 3 or 4 years, that it's all Putin's fault. And if it's all Putin's fault, there's no need to discuss anything. No need for diplomacy. And that's, by the way, the position that Obama, who will leave office as one of the worst Cold War presidents we've had, is the position he took. Why, I'm not sure, but he took it.
Now, to unpack the Ukrainian issue still further, what's happening in the eastern Donbas region?
People are dying. I mean, it's kind of a complicated story, but it's not real complicated. You have to begin with the understanding that the Ukrainian crisis is first and foremost a civil war. Ukraine, for all its virtues, by any reasonable calculation, was a state after the end of the Soviet Union, an independent state, with deep historical, religious, economic, ethnic, linguistic divisions. It didn't mean these divisions were so great they had to erupt into civil war, by any means. Ukraine had managed them without war or civil war since 1991, partly because the elite in all parts of the country, East, Central, and West, was so corrupt that it was good feeding. They were robbing Ukraine blind, and they didn't want civil war. They wanted civil peace, which is good for robbery of a financial sort. So what set off this civil war? The NATO eastern countries, Poland and others, came up with this idea. First of all, they tried to get Ukraine and Georgia into NATO in 2008, and it was vetoed by Germany and France. But the idea of bringing NATO, Ukraine into NATO, was never given up, including in Washington. So they devised this thing called the Eastern Partnership, where they would offer these benign civilizational economic partnerships to these former republics of the Soviet Union, but it wasn't really membership, but it really was a road to membership, but it was just at the hand of friendship. If you look at carefully the economic partnership, 1,000 pages, offered to Kiev by the European Union in 2013, which the president rejected because he figured out it would cost the country $80 billion. The EU wasn't given anything except austerity. And if you're up for re-election in a year, that's not exactly the gambit you're going to pursue. But there was a section called military and security issues in there. And it said that anybody who signed the Eastern Agreement, Partnership Agreement, had to abide by the EU's military and security principles, and that was NATO. So it was lawyer small language, but the Russians have lawyers too, and they saw it, and it meant that if Ukraine signed this, Ukraine would be obliged to side with or conform to NATO. And so when Yanukovych said, and he didn't refuse to sign it, he just said he wanted some more time to think about it, these protests broke out. And by February, he was gone, and his electoral base had been in eastern Ukraine, not only Donbas, but eastern Ukraine, all the way to Odessa, and Crimea. So they thought they were their president. I mean, we say, oh, he was a corrupt, bad guy. They're all corrupt in Ukraine. I mean, really, you want to argue whether Poroshenko's more corrupt than Yanukovych? It's how many angels on the head of a pin. But these people felt that their president, their representation, had been illegally overthrown. And when the government said they were going to abolish the status of Russia as a language, they backed off from that, but it was already too much even to pass it briefly. It precipitated resistance there. Now, since then, we've said that the Donbas rebels are Putin's puppets. In other words, they have no agency, no autonomy. But this is a slur on a people who felt aggrieved by events that we had helped provoked. And the Russians did help them, their army, the rebel army originally, because remember what Kiev did when they had a civil war unfolding. Did Kiev send diplomats to negotiate with its own people? Did Kiev said, well, you misunderstand, we have your interests at heart, come to Kiev, or we'll come to you and we'll work this out. No, they initiated something called the anti-terrorist operation. They called the rebels terrorists. Even Lincoln didn't call Johnny Reb a terrorist. They were still wayward citizens. And they began war. And a rebel army formed. But a lot of people in Donbass had been in the Soviet army, and they knew how to fight. And if you look at the videos of the young people being recruited to form an army, a rebel army, and of course, Ukraine had been the arsenal of the Soviet Union. Lots of weapons were built in Ukraine, Russian-Ukrainian weapons. Ukraine was full of weapons. You can get all the weapons you needed. And the Russians came in and helped them, of course, helped them organize miners, much as we did in Georgia, and as we're doing now in Kiev, Ukraine. I mean, I ask people, how many NATO personnel are in Ukraine today? And you can't get an answer. Well, we know four countries sent 500 miners, trainers, so that's 2,000. But how many more are there? I hear some American National Guards have sent people there. Why, I don't know. So you got both there. But the point here is that there was a format for negotiation called the Minsk Accords, drawn up by France, Hollande, Germany, Merkel, signed by Putin and Poroshenko. And it called for a certain things to be done that would result in a negotiated peace. The primary step was that Kiev had to pass legislation giving the two large Donbas regions, Donetsk and Lugansk, some degree of home rule. They could elect their own mayors, they could have their own police force, they could have a say in taxation, they could use Russian. Now, we've been through this before in Ireland and many other countries, and in the end, it's the only way to end a civil war, is decentralization or federalization or degrees of home rule. But Kiev has never taken these first steps. Why has Kiev refused to do that? Because Poroshenko is a candy maker, not a war maker. I mean, he's a looting oligarch. He's not interested in war. But the ultra-right, a significant part of it, flagrantly neo-Nazi, has armed battalions. We've given them weapons. In fact, it's now said that we'll end the sanctions on Russia when Putin implements the Minsk Accords, but Putin's not blocking the Minsk Accords. It's in Ukraine.
What prompted the Russian intervention in Syria?
Some say he came to reestablish a foothold in the Middle East, which Russia had enjoyed before the end of the Soviet Union. Some say he came to be anti-American, to counter American influence. But I think Putin summed it up very clearly, and his analysis was my analysis, that by mid-2015, it was either going to be Assad in Damascus or the Islamic State in Damascus. And the Islamic State's proclaimed goal was all the holy cities, including Jerusalem, by the way. If that didn't get your attention, then you obviously did not care, actually, about the fate of people. The other thing was that this was seen as a direct threat to Russia because, and the numbers are not clear, but Putin said 7,000, others are, but a lot of thousands of Russia, people carrying Russian passports were fighting with ISIS or the Islamic army. And they had come from the Russian Federation and they were heading back. And Putin was fairly blunt. We're going to kill them there, or they're going to come home and try to kill us. And Syria is not far from Russia. And by the way, Israel has not protested Putin's actions in Syria. In fact, the relationship between Israel, Netanyahu, and Putin has become very, very close.
What is Putin's power base? What are the sources of his support?
No significant political or economic elite opposes Putin. His problem is balancing their conflicting demands on him and interests. Right now we have a major conflict which seems to have led to the rest of the economic minister over privatization. There are people who want to privatize everything. There are people who don't want to privatize very much because they need cash. to plug holes in the budget. And there are some people who want to do strategic privatization, which would seem to be Putin. But there's a war between Putin's Kremlin and the government headed by Medvedev now, a policy war. So he's not an autocrat. He is number one. He is the decider. He makes the final decisions. So the basis of his power is that. The second basis of his power is there's no alternative to Putin's appeared on the scene. But there's no plausible alternative. You could say that's because Putin hasn't permitted an alternative. He doesn't let people on TV. That's not entirely true. Russia is a pretty pluralistic media environment. But the only riveting figure has appeared is this anti-corruption campaigner, Navalny. And they let him run for mayor of Moscow. And he got, he got almost 30% of the vote. He lost. I thought that was terrific. And the other reason is no matter how much you mock it, Putin is enormously popular among the people. And he's popular for a very simple reason. It's not complicated. When he came to power, people were dying and Russia was disintegrating. And then it wasn't. And I have heard Putin repeatedly referred to by rank-and-file Russians, but also by members of the elite, as Vladimir Spasitel, Vladimir the Savior. The fact that he wasn't Yeltsin and he stopped the disintegration that occurred under Yeltsin. And bad things have happened since then. And, disposable income's way down now. People are having hardships again. The number of people living in poverty since the sanctions and the oil prices dropped. But this is not a long time ago. People remember. And people forget that Russia's a family-oriented society. And children remember what happened to their parents during the 1990s, the ruination of their lives. And grandchildren remember what happened to their grandparents. And they don't forget and forgive. So, Putin, all clocks stop. But Putin's political clock is ticking well at home.
How would you describe the health of the civil society? Is it active, vibrant?
It would be more active and more vibrant if we would pull out. Now, Putin's been throwing us out, our agencies for civil society, NGO promotion, democracy promotion out. This has done Russia no good. It's simply created a backlash in Russia against anything that has an American sticker on it or American money with it. Obviously, there's less space for opposition struggle in Russia today than there was a decade or so ago. That's what Cold War does. And Putin's been responsible for that, some of that too. But there's still plenty. There's still plenty. It's not just the leading opposition newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, of which Gorbachev is a 10% owner. But I did the following experiment. I looked at all what we would call the mainstream daily newspapers. There are many more in Russia than there are here. That various segments of the elite would at least glance at on a daily basis. In them, I found no less than five extremely critical of the Kremlin's policy toward the West, mostly thinking it's too hard and harsh. They want the Kremlin to be nicer to the West.
What are the possibilities of some kind of détente or rapprochement with Russia under the new Trump administration?
Trump, I have no idea what's in his head, but he did do two things that distinguished him from any American politician in recent times. He said repeatedly it would be great to cooperate instead of fight with Russia. That used to be called détente. That's Trump's language. And he absolutely refused, even when baited, to vilify Putin as a person. So when Scarborough says to him, "How can you deal with Putin who assassinates people?" Trump says, "I don't know that to be true." And the fact is, it isn't true. There's no evidence he ever assassinated anybody who was a non-combatant. So he simply resisted demonization, and he said he wanted to cooperate with Russia. The entire political establishment, Democratic and Republican, is against this, and they're gearing up to stop any détente by Trump. But he has one card to play. This is the one thing a president can do alone in the Oval Office. You don't need Congress unless you want a treaty. And remember, Reagan was fiercely opposed by his own party. and by distrusted by the liberal establishment when he began detente with Gorbachev. And the way he did it is a model for Trump. All he needs is a Secretary of State, a National Security Advisor, and an ambassador to Moscow. He doesn't need anything else. Does Putin want detente? And I think 100% he does, though the opinion here is he doesn't.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Cohen on Reheating the Cold War. I talked with him in New York. Stephen Cohen, a preeminent scholar and expert on Russia, is professor emeritus of Russian studies, history, and politics at NYU and Princeton. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, part of the nonprofit education organization Rise Up. Our award-winning independent weekly program airs on public radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We're able to cover issues ignored or distorted by the mainstream media because of support from individuals just like you. AR features such progressive voices as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Noam Chomsky, Vijay Prashad, Bill McKibben, Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Stephen Cohen, on Reheating the Cold War, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.